Welcome again to The Road to Maritana and the extraordinary tale of William Vincent Wallace, double virtuoso, global traveller and melodic opera composer, who was born in Waterford. The music, a romance, 'Tis the Harp in the Air, written by Wallace on a favourite melody from Maritana, his most famous opera. This was recorded on a recent CD, alongside his beautiful American music album from 1854, respectfully dedicated to the ladies of the United States. We'll take a look at the original album in the National Library of Ireland later in the programme. "'Tis the Harp in the Air," written by Wallace on a favourite melody from Maritana, his most famous opera. Well, in the last programme we visited Waterford, where Wallace was born. But when he was just 2 months old, the family headed northwest to Ballina in County Mayo. It has only been recently discovered that Ballina town and the surrounding district have long connections with the Wallace family, stretching back over some generations. I caught up with Wallace aficionado David Grant in Ballina to discover more about his formative years.
Well, basically, he was born in Waterford because his father was a member of a militia regiment, which was the North Mayo Militia, which happened to be stationed in Waterford at the time of his birth. But they moved on again fairly quickly. And in fact, for the 4 years between his birth in 1812 and 1816, they actually toured around most of Ireland and even the UK. And in 1816, they came back to Ireland, because after the Battle of Waterloo, the militia regiments were gradually being disbanded. So they were brought back to their home base of Ballina. And Wallace at that stage was only 4 years old, so he actually grew up here in Ballina, where we are today, the really formative years between the age of 4 and the age of 11. And eventually, the regiment, while it was being disbanded, the father managed to stay on because he was a musician, and I suppose the band was being used for social events as well. But eventually, in 1823, the militia was finally wound up, and the father had to find a permanent job as a bandmaster. And he went to one of the regiments of the line, one of the permanent regiments of the British Army, which was the 29th Foot. So they did end up in Waterford again in 1825 for the best part of a year. After that, then, they left the army and moved to Dublin.
I'm Terry Riley. I'm a local historian from Ballina, County Mayo. Absolutely thrilled and delighted to discover the Wallace connection with Ballina, not alone William Vincent's, but his whole family and his father and his grandfather and their connections with the North Mayo Militia, which I'm very interested in. This is the very, very famous, world-famous Ridgepool, where all the top celebrities of the world would have angled here, fished here, the Ridgepool in Ballina. Ballina, of course, being the salmon capital of Ireland. Tiger Woods would have fished here, Ralph Amara, Irish presidents, dignitaries from the world, Richard Branson, you name it, and you have to book here months or years in advance to get on this stretch of water.
And do you think this is the reason why Wallace became so interested?
Wallace would have been captivated by anglers in his period right on this river here, because he had to transverse this river to go to church in Arnery, St. Michael's. And he was seen from a very early age, flycasters, people came from all over the world, even at that stage, even before the famine, and caught lots of salmon here and wrote lots of books about the Moy, fishing in the Moy, and his own special flies. Absolutely fantastic. It would be nothing to catch 30 or 40 salmon in one day here back in the before the famine.
Well, he was certainly an outdoor person. I mean, there are some accounts that he was interested in hunting and I presume fishing also. And there's the famous Angler's Polka, the piece of music that he wrote in America and dedicated to some of his fishing friends. And there's that beautiful illustration on it of the boat and the four people actually out fishing, casting the flies in the river. So as Terry was saying, it's something that he grew up with, and it would have been part of his life, all his life, I would have thought.
We're at right at the front of St. Michael's Church of Ireland in Arnery in Ballina. A very historic church, dating back to the 1760s. A lot of famous people associated with this church, apart from the Wallaces. One really famous person, William Joyce Sewell. He was a hero of the American Civil War. He fought at Gettysburg. Of this town, his people are buried at the back of the church here. He came back and presented two lovely stained glass windows in memory of his folk in this church. And it's just a part of the whole history of the church. The North Mayo Militia memorials inside the church denote the history of the militia, where they travelled, where they got to. In the cemetery are the headstones in memory of people who immigrated to Argentina, all around the world, to Canada. And they're all marked here in this beautiful, quaint little cemetery right attached to the church.
Now, David, there's a very special connection here with this beautiful church, with the Wallaces themselves.
There is, yes. Two of the daughters were actually baptised in this church while the Wallaces were living here in Ballina. First of all, in 1818, there was Susanna Wallace. And then 2 years later, in 1820, the second daughter, Eliza, who was called after the mother, was baptised here. And regrettably, we think that Susanna must have died young, because she disappears from the records fairly early on. But Eliza had a very interesting musical career in her own right. She went with William Vincent to Australia, and she also went to America, and she had a career, and she ended up as a singing teacher in Sydney. And a lot of the opera singers that were produced in the later generations in Australia were actually trained by Eliza Wallace. So their influence was very far flung, obviously.
Rosemary Tuck, with an excerpt from another of Wallace's Irish fantasias, based on two songs from Thomas Moore, Go Where Glory Waits Thee and Love's Young Dream. Meanwhile, I discovered more from Pete Jaggard about the Ballinagh period of Wallace's life.
Well, it's always been there, because if we look at Grattan Flood's memoir, published 100 years ago, this was published by the Waterford News. And obviously, Grattan Flood mentions that Wallace's father was a Ballinagh man. However, Grattan Flood also says, falsely, and he's quite sly here, that Wallace's father married a Waterford girl, and when they came back to Waterford many years later, wasn't Mrs. Wallace happy to be amongst her friends again? Now, this is totally false, because Wallace's mother was a Limerick girl. Wallace spent 3 months in Waterford. His father was a bandsman in the North Mayo Militia, and the North Mayo Militia just happened to be stationed at Waterford at the time. If he'd been born a little earlier, he would have been born in Limerick. If he'd have been born 4 months later, he would have been a Dubliner. Waterford has every right to be proud of being the birthplace of William Vincent Wallace, but it's County Mayo is where his family are from, and that's the place he was brought up from the age of four until he was a teenager. That's where he learnt music.
I also discovered that sorting fact from fiction in Wallace's story is something of a minefield. A lot of what we know about him is based on hearsay and stories, which were perhaps circulated to encourage publicity. Andrew Lamb has recently published a biography on Wallace, and I wonder what challenges that posed.
Sorting out fact from fiction is really what has driven most of my specialist research, and it was particularly so in this case. I'd always known, or long known, of this story of Wallace spending time in Australia, in New Zealand, India, and so on and so forth, and all his adventures. And it was when Peter Jaggard, in July 2010, gave me to understand that maybe he hadn't visited India after all, that I got fascinated enough to start doing my own research to find what was true and what wasn't. But of course, ultimately, it's impossible to distinguish fact from fiction in every case. One can eliminate certain impossibilities, but not define absolutely everything. The most fantastic stories were connected with his trips from Australia to first supposedly New Zealand and then to India. In New Zealand, supposedly he went whaling on a whaling expedition, and the ship was caught by pirates who killed many of the crew. But Wallace somehow survived. He was adopted almost by some of the local chiefs, and he was allowed to, in effect, go through forms of marriage with chief's daughter. And at the end of it all, he decided he wanted to leave, and he was allowed to leave, but only after having some sort of cross cut in his flesh. So that's the New Zealand part of it. Then supposedly he went on to India, where he was feted by Maharajas and went on tiger hunts and came face to face with a tiger, which he managed to shoot through the eyes and kill.
It's great stuff, isn't it?
It's wonderful stuff, but that, as I say, is the most far-fetched of the stories. And since those stories were supposedly fitted into the time between him being in Australia and South America, and we have from present-day newspaper archives information on when he left Australia and when he arrived in South America, we're able to discount those stories at least. What Wallace didn't know, of course, is that nearly 200 years later, something called the Internet would exist, which would enable us to consult newspapers of the time at will and find out that some of the timings of his supposed journeys were impossible.
And I suppose, really, there might have been an element of truth in some of the stories, but they were grossly exaggerated then. I mean, I came across in your book some of the stories that he told to Hector Berlioz. And I wondered if you thought Berlioz intended the reader to take them with a pinch of salt.
I think Berlioz intended the reader to take the whole thing with a huge pinch of salt. The reality is that Berlioz could not possibly have remembered all those details of a story supposedly told to him over lots of bowls of punch at 3 a.m. He must have orchestrated the tales in the way that he orchestrated piano pieces by Weber and so on and so forth. And of course, these tales of Wallace's adventures in New Zealand and India as I say, they were the most far-fetched of all the tales, and they tie in with Wallace's seemingly somewhat undistinguished departure from Australia, supposedly in debt. And obviously news at that time travelled just as fast as the fastest mail coach or the fastest ship, and would then, having left Australia, have been on a ship with no means of communication, not knowing what was happening behind him in Sydney, where he'd left a wife and son and left himself in debt. We don't know whether he concocted stories, as I say, before he left to throw people off the scent, or whether he concocted them subsequently while he was at sea to tell his family afterwards what he'd been up to while he'd been away. But at least there is some sort of reason why he would have had to invent a story at that time.
Wallace married quite young. Her name was Isabella Kelly. And it is said he met his wife while teaching at the Ursuline Convent in Thurles, where she was a pupil. But it appears her father did not approve of the match.
Wallace married Isabella Kelly on Valentine's Day, 1832.
And is it true that they eloped? Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, there's one suggestion that they eloped, and that's family tradition, the Kelly family tradition, Isabella's side of the family. I think it's possible. It's possible. I mean, it's romantic. It might be. But, however, on the other hand, work needs to be done on this, but there is evidence that they had to get special dispensation from one of the big Catholic bishops. And so, I mean, I found a reference to one bishop having to write to a superior bishop, you know, to get permission for this. There's a story there, but it's got to be explored. He must have converted to Catholicism in order to marry in a Catholic church.
Yes, because, of course, Wallace was not a Catholic. But he had been teaching, or so the legend goes, in the Ursuline Convent in Thurles. Isn't that right? And that's where he had met Isabella. Or is that all fiction as well?
Not entirely certain about this. I mean, certainly that some of the Kelly sisters were involved at that convent. Wallace's sister Eliza maintained that she was educated there. So there's no evidence that Wallace's mother wasn't Catholic. Eliza married in the Catholic cathedral in Sydney, and she is buried in the Catholic cemetery in Sydney. She was a Catholic throughout her life, by the sound of it. So it could be that Wallace's mother was Catholic and Eliza was brought up in the Catholic faith.
The relationship with Isabella was to be short-lived. Wallace met the real love of his life, Helene Stoepel, in London in the late 1840s. At the time, she was pianist to the Duchess of Sutherland. I wondered what would have been expected of a personal pianist to a great lady in those days.
I suppose the being a personal pianist would be in effect the same as being along playing CD or a CD today. Rather than putting on a CD when one wanted to listen to music today, one would in those days ask one's pianist to go and play some tunes on the piano. Equally, of course, she would be required to play at the soirees that the Duchess would commonly give, I imagine. Mm. She also she took part in family concerts. She was part of a family of musicians, originally from Germany, who then settled in France in the 1830s. They came over to London around about 1847. She was still in her teens, and they did give concerts, family concerts, and that was when she first appeared on the London scene. But the curious thing is that when she first played in London, Wallace was over in Vienna attempting to get Maritana produced, and he would have missed her initial appearances in London as a result of that. But Wallace would presumably have become familiar with her abilities during the London season of 1848. And then by the summer of 1849, certainly the two were performing together at what seems to be rather more than just coincidental frequency.
We have to remember that back in those days, there was no radio, there were no CDs or anything like that. And people of quality, such as this Duchess of Sutherland, music would have been an integral part of their lives. Just she would have been playing after dinner or even at dinner or and for soirees, all kinds of... I mean, the Duchess of Sutherland was a major figure in London, Lancaster House. I mean, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert actually visited her on one occasion, and they had these fantastic soirees, and Helene may have even got to hear Chopin, because Chopin came to London in 1848, just before his death, and he played at Lancaster House. And I always like to think of Helene standing somewhere behind the curtain in the background, actually listening to Chopin. It must have been extraordinary, because not many appreciated Chopin at that time, when he was totally unknown. Apparently there's a marvellous bit in Victoria's diary about, maybe not that evening, but some evening that Chopin played, where she talked about the various singers and she mentioned them all by name, and she said, "Some pianist played." But Helene must have been an extraordinary musician in her own right. I mean, she was quite a young woman at this stage. We reckon about 21 or 22, give or take a few years, and she'd been trained in the Paris Conservatoire. And it's right, I think, to pay great tribute to Helene, because I think she gave up an awful lot when she became Wallace's partner. I mean, she was a very promising young pianist, and because they had a family quite soon when they went to America, you know, her playing career was not obviously as long as it might have been otherwise. So definitely the love of his life, though. I think what happened to Wallace at this particular time was, apart from circumstances in London not being so good from the economical point of view, he got some bad health. He had a condition called ophthalmia, which affected his eyes, and it meant that he couldn't obviously compose, he couldn't write anything, and it was very debilitating, and it lasted quite a few years on and off. And so he had to try and find some place in which he could operate, you know, as a musician. Presumably he could play the piano, he could play pieces from memory or whatever. So I think one of their major reasons for going to the United States was that they could function over there as performers and so on. He could write salon music, which wasn't as demanding, obviously, as the big operas. And that's, in fact, what he did. According to the newspapers, he was offered $100 for each piece that Hall published. Now, whether that's literally true or not, I don't think it matters. The actual amount, but I mean, he must have done very well out of his publications. And of course, one of the things that Wallace did very early on when he went to the States was he applied for American citizenship, and that was so that he could protect his copyright, because a lot of his stuff had been pirated in America before he went there in the 1850s, and he became very sophisticated in terms of musical copyright. But, of course, the million-dollar question, if you excuse the pun, as to what happened to all this money. And unfortunately, Wallace was a very bad businessman. And he made a lot of money and he squandered a lot of money in various business ventures. For example, he was very fond of smoking cigars. And apparently there was some kind of a tobacco factory or something that he got involved in, whether it was making cigars or not, I'm not sure. But that lost him a lot of money. And there was also a piano company that he established with an American piano maker. And he even set up, a warehouse and so on in New York. But apparently he lost an awful lot of money on that as well. That was the time when the Steinways were just beginning to produce pianos. And as they say, the rest is history when it comes to the piano.
You might remember that Wallace had left Australia in haste to escape debts he had amassed in a piano importing business. But his spirit of enterprise was never quite quenched, and he got involved in another piano business in America, this time developing a patent for a new design of piano with a man called Spencer Driggs. I've never come across one, but from what has been written about the piano, it was capable of producing a great big sound, drowning out all its competitors.
There is something about these instruments so different from anything else that when once heard, you can never mistake them. The tone is sympathetic, and at a distance, you can scarce realize that it is an instrument. They so resemble the human voice. The lower tones are like the tones of a violoncello. They are so full and resonant. In fact, it appears as if the whole instrument must have nerves, muscles, and a perfect sympathy with the player. The extraordinary body and fullness of sound is not so apparent when you are close to the piano as when you are some distance off. Yet every note is as distinct and perfect as those of a violin in the hands of the most skillful performer. It is claimed that these pianos, from the manner of their construction, can be made stronger and at less expense than other first-class pianos. They are to be called the Wallace Piano Forte, and arrangements are being made to get them into the market by the coming spring. The simplicity, novelty, and ingenuity of their construction certainly promise success.
Piano companies were something of a leitmotif in the Wallace story, of course. He was involved in an unsuccessful piano importation scheme in Australia. That was what forced him to flee the country in debt because the business failed. Supposedly, he was also involved in a piano import business in South America as well, where we know there was a lot of demand for pianos. So there was nothing new when he certainly again became involved with this further business, this Driggs design of piano in America in the 1850s. I think we've got to understand how rapidly the whole issue of design of pianos was developing at that time. And Wallace tied himself to this particular design by Spencer Driggs, which he believed was the way forward. It seems ultimately to have been unsuccessful, like so many of Wallace's ventures, because the Steinway design really at that time was going ahead in leaps and bounds and sweeping competitors aside.
Wallace's biographer, Andrew Lamb. So, the Driggs piano business was destined to fail, despite the unique character of Wallace's pianos. However, in other ways, Wallace was a great success in America. His New York publisher, William Hall, was extremely supportive and paid him handsomely for his salon music. Wallace's ballad, Say My Heart, Can This Be Love, sung by Maura Flavin.
Ever still he hovers round me, and his presence yields a thrill. Yet while others warmly praise me, he alone is mute and still. Though sweet flattery pleases ever, and the sternest hearts can move, praises tame unless he praises. Say, my heart, can this be love? Say, my heart, can this be love?
Welcome to Mr. W.V. Wallace. A number of artists and amateurs, numbering altogether about 50 ladies and gentlemen, assembled at the rooms of Messrs. Hall & Sons Broadway last night to meet Mr. Wallace, the distinguished composer, who makes a flying visit to the United States. Mr. Wallace, who joins to undeniable merit as a composer, a very great degree of social popularity, was very warmly greeted by his friends. About half past eight, Mr. Wallace entered the large piano sale room in which the guests were assembled, leaning on the arm of Mr. James Hall, and was continuously and rapturously cheered. After this had somewhat subsided, the chorus performed The Welcome Home from Loreline. The guests adjourned to another room, where a collation, with a liberal supply of wine, was spread. After the appetite of the guests was satisfied, Mr. James Hall, in a neat speech, in which he reviewed the early portions of Mr. Wallace's professional career, introduced that gentleman and proposed his health, which proposition was received with cheers. Mr. Wallace replied in a very humorous manner, thanking his hearers for the great kindness he had received from his many well-wishers, but more especially from Messrs. Hall and Son. Madame Bushell, sister to Mr. Wallace, sang The Cradle Song, composed by that gentleman with much effect. On Wednesday evening, the handsome music rooms of William Hall & Sons in Broadway were agreeably filled with an appreciative company of musical amateurs, performers, and critics, assembled there to welcome back Mr. William Vincent Wallace to the United States. The home of a gifted composer is as wide as the world, for music is the universal tongue. But Mr. Wallace has a particular hold on New York, and he must have learned on Wednesday night that New York claims a particular hold on him.
Some years ago, the National Library of Ireland acquired a very interesting volume of Wallace's music for the drawing room. It was published in New York in 1854 by Wallace's American publisher, William Hall, and this exquisite collection of songs and piano music was respectfully dedicated to the ladies of the United States. The high-quality printing and the embellishments, such as the hand-coloured lithographs in the album, made it a much sought-after and highly prized volume.
Among the most noticeable of recent publications, we select the following from Hall & Sons Broadway, Album for 1854, by W. Vincent Wallace. This is unquestionably one of the handsomest gift books of the season. It is got up in the best possible manner externally and internally. We cannot conceive a more graceful and elegant offering to the ladies of the United States. It contains four canzonets, a ballad, and a trio for female voices, together with a polka, Scottish, waltz, and romance for the piano. Among the vocal pieces, the autumnal canzonet, The Leaves Are Turning Red, and the ballad, Say My Heart, Can This Be Love, are perhaps the most pleasing. The chief attraction of the instrumental portion of the album is the charming air from Maritana, The Harp in the Air, transcribed for the piano. It is by no means easy of execution and is intended, doubtless, as a study. It is written in three staves, the melody being sustained simultaneously with a brilliant accompaniment of chords and octaves through the entire range of the instrument. It is one of Mr. Wallace's most exquisite compositions, and will repay any amount of study that may be devoted to it.
Basil Walsh has written a book on Wallace's compatriot and fellow opera composer Michael William Balfe, as well as one on the Hibernian prima donna of the 19th century, Catherine Hayes, from Limerick. On a recent visit to Dublin, he accompanied myself and Pete Jaggart into the National Library to see Wallace's gorgeous music book.
My name is Honora Fall and I'm an assistant keeper at the National Library of Ireland. Well, we were alerted to the existence of this album by a Wallace enthusiast in Ireland who brought it to our attention, and we were delighted that we were in a position to buy it. So we purchased it in 2009 from J&L Lubrano Music Antiquarians, who were based in New York, for the library. It's such an important album and so beautiful, and there's been such great interest in it since we've acquired it. So it was one of our better purchases, if you like. We were sent images of some of the beautiful lithographic plates in it, and also about the different pieces of music, the 10 pieces of music in the album. So we knew it was a particularly fine album and particularly appropriate for the National Library of Ireland to acquire. There are a couple of copies in the United States, but we haven't found another copy in Ireland or the British Isles. We found that there are a couple of the music pieces in the album in different collections, but as an album itself, as it is presented here, published in 1854, with the 10 pieces and all of the plates together in one album, you know, it really is quite rare. And, you know, we're delighted that we have a copy of this lovely album in the National Library.
Well, I'm kind of interesting that they produced the cover in green, which, you know, somebody obviously thought it was a good Irish colour in those days, I guess, in 1854 in New York, which obviously it would have been. But it's beautifully done. I mean, the gold inlaid or gold leaf or whatever the cover is done with.
Yeah, gold leaf, sort of filigree pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
Around very well, and on the spine.
Yeah.
as well. It's a beautiful presentation album.
And it certainly depicts the sort of the era, the time that it was produced.
Very much. Right, I mean, this was produced for the Christmas market. Christmas 1853 is when it came out. And it was aimed at ladies rather than gentlemen. It was a present for the lady. And it's a very interesting mix for a present. You can imagine, say it was given as a Christmas present. You've got the young lady, intelligent young lady, but she's not a great lover of Bach or Beethoven, you know. Mm. What's it? She's going to say, what have I got in here? These canzonettes with these beautiful illustrations. Do you have a look through? I'm going to need to work on these. Oh, let's look at this one. Ballad. Say my heart, can this be love? Let's go to that. And she would go to that. And you find something which is relatively easy. You can sit down. Da, 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 da. Beautiful. Ever still he hovers round me and his presence yields a thrill. Yet while others warmly praise me, he alone is mute and still. Oh dear, the poor girl said. This is all about love and unrequited love and passion. The passion in the breast. But the amazing thing, it's easy, it's a nice melody. So here you've got immediate gratification. She can go straight to the piano and get this one out.
Ever still he hovers around me, and his presence yields a thrill. Yet while others warmly praise me, he alone is mute and still. Though sweet flattery pleases the sternest hearts can move, praises tame unless he praises. Say, my heart, can this be love? Say, my heart, can this be love? Wayward heart, can this be
this is really the odd one out in here. When Wallace went to America in 1850, Lurline, he'd started writing it, but it was remained unperformed. He'd more or less finished it. He took with him a libretto, the Amber Witch, which he wrote in the USA. This would be perhaps the first opera that was actually performed in a major opera house. Written in America. He also had two others. There was one called The Maid of Zurich, which I believe was a libretto by Fitzball.
But he never completed that, right?
He might have completed it, but it was never performed. But there's a story there as well. But I'm wondering, looking at this, and in The Amber Witch, there's a lovely bell chorus in Act One, and it reminds me a bit of this. It seems to be the sort of music that he would have been writing at the time. You've got bells here, and I'm wondering if perhaps he'd taken this from The Maid of Zurich, because I mean the words are interesting. I mean the second verse, especially, talking of the nuns on the battlefield. Helping the wounded.
When the solemn convent bell pealeth forth the vesper hour.
Daring young lady with a happy summertime. It's a bit of June is busting out all over here. unless she is wearing a rather flesh-coloured vest. She's holding a sickle, a little sickle. Two plaits, one on either side, coming down the front. The hair is very much...
And the corn, look at the sheep.
Yes, yeah, that's what she's just been reaping it, isn't she?
Yeah.
An evening, the ladies in the drawing room had little else to do apart from their needlepoint. Lively, pretty, beguiling music. That's what Wallace's songs and piano pieces meant to ladies in the American drawing rooms. I hope it also brought a little excitement into what must have been an otherwise dull existence. Join me again next time for the final programme in The Road to Maritana, when I'll be looking at Wallace's operas, the pinnacle of his achievement as a composer. Also, a visit to Kensal Green Cemetery in London, where he's buried beside Ireland's other distinguished opera composer, Michael William Balfe. I'll leave you with my recording of the final piece in the 1854 Wallace Music album, The Invitation Polka.
Invitation Polka from William Vincent Wallace's 1854 music album, played there by Una Hunt. The Road to Maritana was presented and produced by Una Hunt, with newspaper extracts read by Roger Gregg. The music producer was Jonathan Allen and the music engineer was Ben Rowlands. Contributors in that programme included Dr. David Grant and Peter Jaggard, two of the leading authorities on the composer, Wallace's most recent biographer, Andrew Lamb, Irish music and opera expert, Basil Walsh, Honora Fall, assistant keeper at the National Library of Ireland, and Terry Riley, local historian in Ballina, County Mayo. Wallace's music was performed by pianists Una Hunt and Rosemary Tuck and Moira Flavin, mezzo-soprano. The Road to Maritana is a heritage music production for RTÉ Lyric FM and is made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision Broadcasting Funding Scheme. The series continues next week with a look at Wallace's career and fortunes as an opera composer and a visit to his grave at Kensal Green Cemetery in London. For more information or to listen to our archive programmes, visit the Lyric feature page of the Lyric website, where you'll also find contact details for the programme.